Welcome to the inaugural Bob Lefsetz podcast. I used to podcast about 10 years ago with Rhino. I was ahead of the curve. We'll find out if I'm behind the curve now. I'm now working with TuneIn. I'm in the TuneIn office and studio in Santa Monica. And I felt for the initial podcast, it would be best if someone interviews me so you can learn a lot about me. So I have my old friend who's the chief growth officer of Insomniac, John Boyle. John?
Hi, Bob. Thank you so much for having me.
Yes. So
we've done this before.
We've done it at EDM Biz. We did it on the Summit Series Ship. But going back, you went to UCLA. Was your first gig doing Snowcore and those other concert promotions?
No. The first gig was booking shows at UCLA, and then I was in a band.
You were in a band? I didn't know that.
I was in a band.
What kind of music was it?
It was Lynyrd Skynyrd meets Guns N' Roses.
No wonder you love those acts.
Of course I do. And
what did you do? You were the singer.
No, I was the drummer.
You were the drummer, really?
No, and I was the manager.
Okay. Although they always say the drummer is the business guy, so it makes sense you're still in the business.
So we did quite well, actually. And then during college, I started booking.
We did quite well. How far did you get?
Well, I mean, we like toured up and down. We toured the Western U.S. in colleges. We were a college party band.
Really? So what was a gig worth?
It was worth a really good time and some parties, and that's kind of what it was about.
I mean, what was it? A grand? $1,500?
No. We were getting up to like $5,000 a show.
Okay, that's pretty good. In case this business thing doesn't work out. Okay, so you did that, and then you did shows at UCLA.
Yeah. And then that led to ESPN launched the X Games.
Right.
And I got to book that initially, and then there was the U.S. Open of Surfing, and then there was just all these lifestyle events. I'm from Lake Tahoe. I grew up on skis. I was a competitive ski racer, as you know.
Absolutely.
We'll talk about this, I'm sure, shortly.
Okay.
and I fell into the surf, skate, snow scene at UCLA. I didn't really know. I grew up in Tahoe. I really didn't know what anything was anything. I was a blue-collar kid. And then all of a sudden, the surf, skate, snow thing blows up. I find myself working with Offspring and
This is what, like 91, 92?
No, this is like 89, 90.
Okay.
And 91 and 92. And then Kevin Lyman, you know, shortly thereafter launches the Warped Tour.
Right. And so how were you involved with the Warped Tour?
Well, as I was doing my shows, I needed a real producer to produce them because I was just a kid.
Right.
And Kevin came in and produced them. And then when Kevin started the Warped Tour, he invited me to be his sponsorship and marketing guy, which I did. Simultaneous to that, I got a phone call from Irving Azoff and Steve Backer, a Giant Record, saying, whatever it is you do, can you do for us? And you can do your side hustle, you can do your other hustle on the side, which was at the time Warped Tour. And then I moved from Giant Records to Virgin Records and launched Snowcore. And it's kind of been a wonderful ride.
Then you turned into a manager and you managed Exhibit.
Yes, I did. I managed Exhibit. I managed Alien Ant Farm. I managed quite a few rock bands. I spent a couple of years at Sanctuary.
Right.
A place you're very familiar with.
Yeah, but I was there long before it was what you were at. The same guys running it.
Same guys running it.
But you were doing that. And then it all came to a stop and you went for an MBA.
It did. Everything kind of slowed down. I was immune to the Napster wall that everybody hit until a couple of years later. And then I stopped and I went back and got a dual MBA from Columbia and the Haas School of Business at Berkeley.
Okay, so when you got that MBA, did you think you were going to come back to the music business?
I kind of thought I wouldn't come back to the music business, but as Al Pacino or Michael Corleone says in The Godfather 3,
right,
the more you try to get out,
they pull you right back in.
And I got pulled right back in by another Italian named Pasquale Rotella.
Right. So you helped Pasquale with his deal with Live Nation.
I was very fortunate to help Pasquale with his deal.
So without making this whole podcast about you.
No, this is about you. I don't know why we're talking about me.
Wait, what is the status of the electronic music world today?
Well, I think the status is for Insomniac is incredibly healthy. I think there's saturation in the festival business at large in North America and in Europe. But the juggernauts thrive and survive, right?
Why don't you, just for our audience, in case they're not clued in, just say what Insomniac does.
Insomniac runs the largest dance music festivals in the world, around the world.
And they are?
Electric Daisy Carnival, EDC in Vegas, the flagship version in Vegas, does 140,000 people a day. It's the largest single weekend festival in certainly in North America, maybe the world, I'm not quite sure. And we've launched it in Brazil, Mexico, India, the UK, Japan. There's a big another Asia announcement coming. It's been incredible being a part of this.
And
I'm a rock guy. You know that.
I know that. Well, we all, you know, are hip to what's coming down the pike. Did you although Pasquale, I ran into him the other day and he told me you're getting into hip hop too now.
Yeah, no. So Insomniac is getting into hip hop. I mean, look, Pasquale's a genius. He's an absolute genius. He's a visionary. He is the number one, like, he's the authority in dance music on the entire planet. And when he pulled me back in, so to speak, 5.5 years ago, I really didn't know what I was in for. And I couldn't be more grateful.
Now, you give good answers. Pasquale's been in the business since like the early 90s. For people to know, you know, it's like the 10,000 hours thing.
Wide Awake since 1993. That's the company logo. Wide Awake since 93.
Right. And it's funny, you sit with all those guys, they have stories, you know, when it was the rave culture, et cetera. But obviously there's been a peak, let's call it four or five years ago. Are we still at that same peak?
No, I don't think there was a peak. I think there was a plateau about 2 years ago. And so where I really think the opportunity is now is in Asia. I've been spending a lot of my time in Asia. South America, a lot of opportunity, but you got political instability, you got currency challenges, you got all – it's still third world.
That's why you need an MBA.
Asia is where – by the way, we could talk about this in the music business across the board. Asia is the opportunity.
Okay. But
can we stop talking about me and talk about you?
No. Just a couple more questions. What is driving attendees at this point to electronic music festivals?
Well, I think it's I know it's the element of community, and it's also the element of being accepted. Other music festivals, you kind of have to fit into a certain, just a certain style or a certain niche, right? At dance music festivals and Insomniac festivals in particular, you can be you, and you are accepted and welcomed, and it's really a beautiful thing. I mean, I feel like I've been a part of making the world a better place for the last few years, and that's a hard thing to say, coming from dance music with all the negative press that it gets, but it's true. Let me ask you, what was your experience when you came to EDC?
Well, you have to go back. I went to Hard Halloween the first time. Eric Hertz, who's a guy with Bill Silva, now part of the Live Nation Empire, he says, you have to come. You have to come. And it was at USC, where now there's a big dorm, but there was a big open space. And the funniest thing was running into people said, we were at the football game at USC. You're not going to believe what was going on. I go, I was there.
Right.
Okay. So it was a separate culture and it was fascinating. Going to EDC, I was just talking about it last night. The single thing that made the biggest impression on me was the helicopter ride.
I knew we were going to get to the helicopter ride.
The point is, for those who don't know, because it's electronic music festival, you go, they got the pulsing lights and everything at the helicopter station. Then they weigh you, which does not encourage you. And it's an inherently frightening experience because not the company we used, but the other company that flies out of Vegas are the ones who crashed at the Grand Canyon. So they walk the, helicopter to the takeoff space and they go. And on the way there, you were talking over the headphones and it was totally calm. When I left at like 4:30 in the morning, I was with the guy from Live Nation, Mexico, and a guy from Brazil.
No. You were with the George from Ocesa in Mexico and Fernando from from Brazil.
Well, first of all, in Brazil, he was talking about how many bodyguards he had, and he flies on the helicopter. They passed out because it was so early in the morning or late at night, depending on how you want to see it. They passed out within like 15 minutes. It was just me and the pilot. And what happened was nothing happens fast in the music business, nor does it happen fast at 4:30 in the morning. So I'm BSing with the pilot while we're waiting to get who's going to go on the ride with us? And he says he was in the military. I'm feeling incredibly confident. The guy flew helicopters in the military. What could be better? But we talked long enough. He didn't fly helicopters in the military. It wasn't until he got out. He'd only been flying for 2 years. What I know about helicopters is if the rotator stops going, if the rotor stops going, it just plunges. People tell me otherwise, whatever. So if there's a fuck up, you die. Whereas with a plane, there's a good fighting chance. So inherently, there's some anxiety.
Well, and I mean, Bill Graham died.
Exactly.
And the
Stevie Ray Vaughan died.
And the CAA, exec died. I forget his name, but
right. Yeah. There's so many people, you know, the helicopter accidents. But going to the EDC itself, one thing they do, and I'm going to, you know, stroke you on Insomniac. Once you get in, you don't have to pay anything else. Every other festival is nickel and diming you. And then they had a spot where you could get your phones charged. And it's almost like that old song, Too Many Fish in the Sea. Short ones, tall ones, big ones, small ones. All kinds of people were out, and it was accepted, and there was a lot of money spent that was unnecessary. What I mean by that, there were timed explosions at certain hours and fireworks, and it made you feel like you were at something special. Of course, it's like, you know, the funny thing is we live in a society where everything gets press. So theoretically, if you want to Google, you can find out about anything. But because there's so much information, there are secret worlds. And when you're out in the desert at this racetrack outside of Vegas, you really feel like everybody should come once just to see what the fuck is going on here, because they really don't have any idea. And especially that all, you know, Coachella, Lollapalooza, they always cover them. Although the New York Times didn't send somebody to Coachella at this point because they felt they weren't breaking any new ground musically. So there's not as much news about these things they used to, but their experiences, and the millennials are about experiences. You have to go just see what's going on.
Well, no, and thank you for coming when right. You did come. It was, I mean, look, EDC is the biggest production on the planet. You saw it firsthand. I've seen them all. There is no bigger production on the planet.
You're there.
And by the way, I see the cost structure that goes behind it. Like, it's the biggest production on the planet.
Well, the funny thing is, you know, you're at the racetrack and you see that many trailers, you know it's a really big operation. Not to mention the fact I've been to Indianapolis Motor Speedway, but I've never been to like a NASCAR track, whatever. You see the banks. And we're there. Who was I talking? We were hanging. I was talking to Afrojack because everybody's hanging out. It's an interesting situation.
Right. Everybody's there. No, but to your point, it's a 2 mile track, right? So the NASCAR tracks run between 1 and 2 miles. It's a 2 mile track. I mean, it's a huge footprint. And you know what? It's really a beautiful show.
Hey, it's Bob Lefsetz. I thank you for your time. Thanks for listening to my inaugural podcast. Remember to subscribe on TuneIn, iTunes, or wherever you get your podcasts. Okay, but now it's time to switch gears as promised.
Thank God.
Now that we've
Please,
been
let's stop talking about me. Jesus Christ.
So now
Christ.
It's time for you to quiz me.
All right.
You know, I'm just going to get a little pricey. The key is not to leave anything in the green room, so we do no preparation. I don't know what – it sounds like I'm doing a TV show now. I don't know what I'm going to be hit with, but go for it.
No, but – so let's be clear. I begged Bob – so Bob and I first met in 1996 at the – what was then known as
– the Aspen Artist Development Conference.
Correct. It's now known as Aspen Live, and Bob writes about this – every single fucking year. It's a big part of your life, right?
You know, so much of my social life is based on that. You know, people, for those who don't know, you can Google it, Aspen Live. It's the antithesis of usual music festival. There are no bands. And it is in Aspen and you go skiing. And some people think it's a circle jerk, but the converse happens. Because there are no bands, you go skiing, you really get to know people. That's how I know John. And the key point, we were in the Buffalo Club. And he asked for – John is like the tumbler in the Catskills. And he's asking for predictions.
I don't even know what that means, but whatever.
He's the guy who makes everything happen.
You mean the straw that stirs the drink?
That's something in addition. That's what Reggie Jackson said when he was at the Yankees. But I don't want to mix the metaphors here.
Okay.
At the Catskills, and most of those hotels are closed, they had a guy who ran around called the tumbler who always made activities spontaneously. So you stood up and asked for predictions, And you had given me shit before that. And I said, within 12 minutes, Geffen Records, 12 months, Geffen Records would close, which it did.
You're right.
But that was one thing. But that's how we met.
Well, and I didn't know you at the time.
No.
I look at Bob as like my older brother from another mother. He's not old enough to be my dad. He would be my older brother, right?
And I don't have an older brother. It's good to have or any brothers at all.
And we were both part of that first Aspen conference,
right?
Very involved,
absolutely,
right? And I think I was the MC of the dinner or something, and I think I called you. And I've admitted to this. I think I called you the annoying bald guy.
It was that or worse. It was definitely a put down. I've blocked it from my memory, but I remember the insult.
So I apologize to you for probably the 100th time here.
Well, you know, I've had a lot of psychotherapy at this point. You know, people think that I'm a guy who's very honest. And when you're in the music business.
You are very honest.
You're in the music business long enough, you know there's the surface and the layer beneath the surface. And people think if you're intense on the surface, you must be a real motherfucker underneath. But I am who I am. So therefore, people may be thrown off guard at first, but then they realize, you know, there's no artifice underneath it. So ultimately, you know, this is me.
Yeah, and, you know, I think – So Bob and I have done some interviews together a couple times at a few different things. And what I usually tell everybody out of the gate is this guy is one badass motherfucking skier. Like, he fucking rips. And by the way, this is coming from a guy who grew up in Tahoe and was a junior Olympian. So Bob is a really, really
good skier.
Not that you – I did win all the ski races.
Yes, you did.
In the first few years. But – you are really, really good, and I think that was something that brought us together.
Absolutely. Our roots in the mountains.
Our roots are in the mountains. So, all right. So let's talk about you. Connecticut, right?
Right. I grew up in Connecticut in the suburbs, Fairfield, Connecticut. That's 50 miles from New York City. Why that's important is that's New York media, New York radio, New York television. At the time, it was rare for someone to commute to New York from Fairfield, but now it's more common. But my mother was a real culture vulture. We were constantly going in to see plays, musicals. We would go with school. But staying with what I said earlier, we had the three networks plus three independent stations. The only place that had more independent television stations was Los Angeles with four. And, of course, we had multiple AM radio stations, certainly 77. We had Cousin Brucey, who's now on the satellite again. I was a big Cousin Brucey fan. And we had Scott Muni, number one in the nation, the Scott Muni Show, who flipped over to FM, okay? And FM underground radio started in San Francisco in 1967. One could say 1966 with Tom Donahue, and started in New York in 1977, WOR-FM. And it had Scott Muni, who eventually went to WNEW. But I was there being in the New York radio market. We could get all those stations. So I heard all those records.
So what was the moment? What was the moment you knew that music was your calling? Or did you not know? Because you went and got you're an attorney.
Okay.
Many people don't know this.
I am an attorney, but we're getting ahead of the story. You know, generations are changing and people are rewriting history. Okay. People say that, oh, the Beatles filled a vacuum after JFK got shot. Like everybody else my age, I certainly remember where I was when JFK got shot. I was at the bowling alley. Okay.
Wow.
We were watching it on TV. But the Beatles were just a revolution in sound. It was, they didn't start to play the records till right after Christmas because radio stations locked their playlists over Christmas. It was within 24 hours, okay? Everybody started to grow their hair immediately. Everybody got a guitar at that time. Before that was folk music. We even had hootenanny shows on television, and I had learned to play a nylon string guitar, but it wasn't until after the Beatles that I got an electric guitar. It was.
You've never talked about this.
Well, here we have it. And I was a shitty guitar player. Let me be very clear. I mean, it's funny because you listen to the radio and they play some of these records. Some of these songs are incredibly easy to play, like Gloria. It's three Van Morrison song made popular in America by Shadows of the Night, and Dirty Water. That was another easy one. But I had my friend Mark, and my friend Mark, remember he traded his guitar, got an ES-335, and we were playing in his bedroom one day, and he said, well, let's change keys. And that's when I knew I was done. I was also embarrassed. I was with a guy who still plays in bands, and they were going to get gigs, and I felt like I was not good enough. But I subsequently got I worked for a summer and I bought an expensive acoustic guitar, which my mother put in the crawl space and has some mold on it now. It's Gibson.
You still have it though.
I still have it. They say they'd fix it at Gibson, but I got
You could sell that for
whatever. Gibson, you know, they said they would fix it and it was really good. And I played a little bit the first year of college, but college was so disorienting after living in the suburbs. I went to college in Vermont. I did not play after that.
University of Vermont.
No,
right?
No, I went to Middlebury College.
Oh, Middlebury, that's right.
Which is a half hour from so going to college, I could have gone to Middlebury or Columbia. I didn't go to Columbia primarily because a guy I'd been on a summer program with wanted to room with me, and I didn't want to room with them, and I didn't know how I would get out of it. So if I go to Middlebury, I don't have to worry about it.
But Middlebury is where really the skiing kicked in, right?
No. If we want to talk skiing for a minute, I grew up, as I say, in Connecticut when it still used to snow in Connecticut, and my friend Bobby Hickey used to ski. And he let me try his skis, and I convinced my parents to buy me skis. It was the skis, bindings, and poles for $10. And we used to ski in Bobby Hickey's backyard with a vertical drop of maybe 25 feet. Then
you walk back up, right?
Of course you walk back up. And you have the floodlight, you ski at night, whatever. And in the days of flannel-lined jeans. So in sixth grade, Mr. Conley, he showed a 30-minute promotional video from Mount Snow, which is a large ski area in southern Vermont.
I've been there, yeah.
You've been there. It must have been, like, for work.
It was for work.
Because otherwise—
It was horrible.
As I say, if you can ski in the east, there's no reason to—
It's not Squaw Valley.
So it certainly isn't. But it's a large ski area in Vermont. I don't want to put Mount Snow down. But we went, my family got hooked, and then we rented a house in Vermont, and then we bought a house in Manchester, Vermont. And I was skiing 35 to 50 days a year before I went to Middlebury. Yes, I went to—it was either—both Dartmouth and Middlebury have their own ski areas— But Dartmouth has a lower altitude and is in New Hampshire. And when I applied to college, Dartmouth was not scheduled to go co-ed for a number of years. And I went to Middlebury. It was co-ed. It's still a very beautiful campus. And they have their own ski area. And I could go skiing every day, which I did. The funny thing is, of everything that happened to me in college, okay, the one thing I did in college was ski. That's the one thing I still do. Forget what courses I took, the people I hung with, whatever. So I did get something out of college. And then I lived in Utah for a couple of minutes, starving on the freestyle ski circuit. I mean, the first year I was in college, it's funny, I'm talking about skiing as opposed to what might have happened in college. First year I was in Vermont was one of the great years ever.
By the way, you're wearing a veil vest. Right,
exactly.
This second.
Well, you know, it's funny because when I lived in Utah, you poo-pooed veil. A good friend of mine was this guy who's Scott Brooksbank, who was the winner of the freestyle championship, and he had a house in Utah, and my friend lived there, so I was there all the time, and he came from Vail. I said, Vail, it's flat. They actually have one very steep bump run called Highline, which he trained on, but I used to poo-poo Vail. Then I got involved with my girlfriend 12 years ago, and since the 70s, they have a condo in the closest building to the Lisset Vale. And I'm getting older. Now I don't poo-poo Vale so much. But after the next 3 years I was in college, it was very bad snow years before many ski areas had snow guns. And I went to live in Utah. I got a job at the gold miner.
This is post-college, right?
Yes. I got a job at the
gold miner. Right out of college.
Right out of college.
You moved to Utah.
I mean, let's be very clear. It was a totally different world from today. There was a middle class. Nobody I know went straight after college. If there were recruiters on campus, I certainly didn't meet with them. And I signed up for the LSAT because my father wanted me to take it. And my friends knocked on the door the night before and said, you're not going to take that, are you? Let's go to Montreal. So we did. I didn't take it. So I
went. And you went to Montreal?
Yes, of course.
To do what? Ski?
No, it was just to do something for that day. Okay. But I didn't take the LSAT. And going to Middlebury. Middlebury has gotten some traction because they had a big protest there last spring. But before that, people would say, Middlebury, is that someplace in Connecticut? No one knew Middlebury College, except in ski areas. It's because it's the best college with a ski area, okay? They say Dartmouth is a thing unto itself, but everywhere you go, every ski area, there are people from Middlebury. And I lined up a job at the gold miner's daughter, best job you can get, being a waiter. You never have to work when the lifts are open. And I got it because I went to Middlebury. But I came to L.A. I worked in a sporting goods store. It no longer exists. It's Hollywood and Highland, Star Sporting Goods. And all the stars used to come in, had a conversation. This was just with Jack Nicholson just before he went to film One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. And he was so cool. And I worked there for a month. The guy wanted to give me the store. I was planning to quit to go back to Utah. Then, to a freak accident, I broke my leg. I went skiing at Snow Summit. I mean, these are ridiculous stories.
Well, you should never go skiing at Snow Summit.
Just for those people who don't know, these are ski areas at a very high altitude within 2 hours of L.A. The car I went in literally burned up, and the only skis I had were very long skis and short skis, and I took the short skis feeling that no one would have a ski rack, but the bindings would not get tight enough. The bindings came off at 10 feet in midair, and I landed, and my leg was broken. And so I missed my job in Utah. I took the LSAT, and I ended up getting a job at Snowbird at a place still exists. Alta and Snowbird are now connected. They're right next to each other, Little Cottonwood right. Canyon. And it's a place called the Bird Feeder, which is right by the tram where you sell hot dogs. And I would curry favor with people by giving them large ice cream cones. I did not know that at the time Snowbird was the epicenter of freestyle skiing. Everybody would come. And then, I mean, what happened was I was waiting for the tram very late in the season, and I'd missed, didn't ski till the end of January because I broke my leg in the beginning of November. And these guys, this guy I ran into said, oh, all the freestylers were going to Mammoth. And they came in for ice cream cones, which they would every day.
And you gave them big scoops.
Big scoops. Huge. And they said, yes, we're going to Mammoth for a month. And they said, come to this frat house. We're going to have a meeting on the University of Utah campus. And I went there on a snowy night where they were playing Physical Graffiti. And I gave them my $50. They went to bang the bumps at Heavenly Valley. If you really know skiing, the barrel at Heavenly Valley is a big thing. Nobody had any money, so they'd use acetone to peel off the tickets from people's wickets and then use those tickets.
I remember.
And I stayed up all night the night before I went to Reno, where I had to go to the Hart Ski Factory, exchange some skis, and listening to Physical Graffiti. And I got stopped for speeding. Because that was after they lowered the speed limit. There didn't used to be a speed limit in Nevada. That was $15. I was really scraping. I went to the Hart Ski Factory and got some new skis and then drove to Mammoth. It's a really beautiful drive. People have no idea. They think of mountains as being Colorado and Utah.
Many times, yeah.
As
yeah.
I say, but if you drive from Reno, the back road, 395 to the backside of Yosemite, it's beautiful. And I got to Mammoth a little early. The gig was we were going to meet at the stop sign at noon. I didn't even really know these people. And I drove up the access road, and that was the first time I heard Tangled Up in Blue by Bob Dylan. And then I met these guys at the stop sign. I didn't think I could stay because I didn't have enough money. And I called my parents deciding whether I could stay. And I got a $35. So I could stay on $2.30 a day. There was a spring pass.
Did you just say $2.30 a day?
Yes.
Okay.
It was a spring pass you could buy for $50. And everybody, I still have contact with those people. That was the best month of our lives. Literally in the
And you write about this. Right. Still regularly. Right.
That's how I got back into Led Zeppelin, listening to Physical Graffiti every day. I was really into them in the beginning. But 10 years gone, which I loved. And then I decided I would compete on the freestyle circuit.
So we can go back. We can go back to your history because I want to go back there. But can we not agree that Led Zeppelin is the greatest band that ever walked the face of the earth?
I'm going to say something different that we used to say in college. Somebody said it to me in college. Name a better record than Who's Next. Now, you might be able to name it. No, Led Zeppelin is a unique thing. What I say, people say, when you go to a desert island, what would you take? I said, I'd take Joni Mitchell Blue and AC/DC Back in Black. So certainly Led Zeppelin is great, although I pretty much stop, although I certainly have all the records. I thought Presence was, you know, the records after Physical Graffiti were a disappointment. But yeah, those records are great.
I mean, one, two, four.
Well, one.
Physical Graffiti, like.
Right. One, I say, you know, your time is going to come. You know, lying, cheating, hurting. I sing that to myself when I ski. That and Little Feet's Easy to Slip. But just to go back to your earlier question, my mother was a culture vulture. In our family, my father used to always say, well, we don't have the big house because it's the house that we moved into 6 months after I was born. And my mother only sold it 10 years ago. And but there was an unlimited amount of money for cultural expeditions. If I wanted to go to the movies, my mother really, she would go to these Judith Crist movie weekends. There was always money for movies. There was always money for concerts. She would hip me to something. She said, oh, Country Joe and the Fish, I see they're in New Haven. And I would get tickets. So, yes, I was very into it before, you know.
You knew very early on this was part of you.
Right. And as I say, you know, if I go on about this, we don't have time to go on. You know, there's a lot of important history elements, okay? Certainly when I got to college, I had more records than anybody else. And therefore, I curried favor with all the upperclassmen, and I had two radio shows. But then, when my generation took over, they were jealous, and I got demoted. I could be on once every other week, and I said, forget it. So then I taught a
Nothing's changed.
Right. And then I taught a course about, you know, in Middlebury, they have the 414 system. You take one course intensively in the winter. And I convinced the administration to let me teach a story about rock music. And there's a lot of elements that come together here. I was in you had to take an English course. That was the one required course other than your major. And I never did this again. I called the professor and asked him whether I could do something creative. I did, and I got an A. In Middlebury, nobody got an A. And I called my mother from the payphone, and I said, I'm going to be a writer. And she laughed, okay? So I felt like, okay, I graduated from college. Either I'm going to move to Stanford.
This is pre-law school.
Absolutely. Okay. I graduated from college. That's the first couple of weeks of college.
Right.
But then, just to be very clear, I mean, I took the creative writing course. This is 1972. And the guy wrote C stories unsuccessfully. And you go to Middlebury, it's a small school. There was only one creative writing teacher. And he said, my stories needed a twist. I said, a twist? Did you ever hear of the new journalism, which is already old, a twist? I would read in class. It was like springtime for Hitler. Because you had all of these people who were, you know, prep school kids, whatever. So I felt when I was in college, when I graduated, I would either go try to get a job with Rolling Stone in San Francisco or try to pursue the ski thing. But I was so burned out on writing that I pursued the ski thing.
Yeah, but it served you well because, I mean, you got this passion, right? And it's part of your life. And, by the way, how important has skiing been in your career? I mean,
okay. There's a song on the Run with the Pack album called Simple Man by Bad Company. And it's an incredible record. It goes, freedom is the only thing, means a damn to me. And when you are out skiing, it's one of the few things you can do with total freedom. You get out in your car, you drive 100 miles an hour, you're going to get stopped. Okay? Ski slope, you can do whatever you want. You can kill yourself. Hopefully you won't. Okay? And the other great thing about skiing is, when you ski, you can't think about anything else. You'll fall. You can think about something on the lift, but once you ski, it requires totally being in the moment. The sensation, the only sensation I found better than skiing is sex. And you can ski whenever you want. You can't necessarily get laid whenever you want. So I don't want, you know, it's one of these things. Skiing is like music now, which is unfortunate. They're both mature. Yes. When I started skiing in the 60s, they were still developing new ski resorts. There were all these great technological revolutions. The big revolution in skiing 25 years ago was the high-speed lift. Now it's more of a middle to upper-class sport, and the same ski areas exist. It's the same thing in music. It used to be a renegade business. You would go to concerts in the 60s. The sound was terrible, and people couldn't play. It wasn't until the mid-70s that the sound was good. Now most of the concerts are done by either Live Nation or AEG. There's three major labels. There's not the renegade spirit. What we saw in the last 20 years in the internet sphere was that renegade. There was always something new. That's been consolidated too. So that's unfortunate, but it's exciting to be at something when it's being developed. Just like snowboarding, although snowboarding's now going downhill because it's reached a peak.
Right. I agree. I think skiing will come back in a little bit in the conversation. Okay. But where we need to get to is, okay, you go to Mammoth, you've done Park City, you go to Mammoth, you get your law degree. And then you end up in the music business.
No. Let's be very clear. I always wanted to be in the music business.
Okay.
And I knew at the time, it's changed at this point. There were six major labels. Three of them were run by lawyers. My father's a real estate appraiser. I have no connections. I figure if I go to law school, it will help me get a start in the music business. I went to law school. It was so boring and terrible.
Is this after Mammoth?
Yes.
Okay.
Because I got the world's worst – okay, just to go back. First year I'm in Utah. Let's be very clear. This is at Snowbird. And the second year I go back to Snowbird, and I choke on the freestyle circuit, okay? Then there's a new rival one that I'm competing in. Then I get the world's worst case of mononucleosis. And I applied to law school, and I didn't think I would go. And then I was so down and out, and I went. And it was terrible. I was going to drop out. But it was literally the world's worst. You know, people are – one thing that bothers me about society in general, and certainly the music business, people are always rewriting history. But I say it was the worst year in the history of snow in the West Coast. And it was 76 to 77.
There was no snow.
Okay?
I remember.
And so I called telling people, hey, you know, should I come to Utah? I said, don't come. We're leaving. There's no snow. But then it happened again 2011, 2012, and they started writing about 76, 77. So I went to law school in L.A., and I fell in with some woman. It was my first big romance. That carried me through law school.
You've written about this, too.
Yeah. Right. So since you go to law school, I'm going to pass the bar. I mean, I'm not someone to go 3 years for law school and not take the bar.
Of course.
So one of the reasons you want to live in L.A., because that's the epicenter of the music business. So I used to go to the record store. I would do all my studying like the first 3 days of the
week. Is this Tower on Sunset?
No. I certainly went to Tower on Sunset. I went to a place which was called Grammy and Granny on Gailey Avenue. And there was also—
In Westwood.
In Westwood.
Wow.
Okay. They had all the promo records. Expensive promo record was $2.49. You get other things for $1.99. There's so many records I bought that I took a chance on. Carla Bonnoff's debut album to this day, one of my favorite albums I bought as a promo. The first Alan Parsons Project record bought as a promo. So many things. So I bought, I mean, I was a regular customer. They would save records. Like, you know, the Eagles' Long Run comes out, they'd save a copy. They had the promo. So I was heavily invested in going to shows. That was my passion living in L.A. Law school was secondary. So when I graduate from law school, you take the bar in July, but you don't find the results till the week before Thanksgiving.
Right.
And certainly, if I didn't pass the bar, I was going to take it again. But in the interim, I got a job because I wasn't going to try to get my real my dream job in the music business. I got a job with an entertainment lawyer whose work was primarily in the movie business.
Do we name him?
Yeah, Sam Perlmutter. He is famous for one thing. If you
he is famous, yes.
He's famous primarily. He brokered the deal for the George Foreman grill. But he represented a lot of people, and I was the only guy wanted me
to. But he made more money from the George Foreman grill.
Of course.
Yes.
And he, at the time, he represented people who had had songs on the Bad Girls album from Donna Summer. Because of a legal issue, she'd left her management, her publishing, everything. And I worked on those royalties. In addition, they had songs in major movies, and I negotiated those deals. Then I hated it. I passed the bar, and I quit. And I said, I'm going out to be a manager. And then I starved. And he called me back in because he'd gotten a really big client. At the time, Canon Films, they were the biggest independent film company of the early 80s. And worked with that. And then I got a job working with this guy, Charles Band. Charles is still around. He's basically in the horror genre. And At the time, we had multiple divisions. He started the first independent video cassette company, which were horror movies. He made movies. We had video games, the Halloween and Texas Chainsaw video games. We also made records. He put Demi Moore in her first movie, Parasite, in 3D.
Wow.
And we made a deal with her husband, Freddie Moore, who had one of the hip bands. There was a big scene in the late 70s, new wave scene in L.A. He had a band called The Cats. They were then called The New Cats. Ultimately, they were called Boy Next Door. And we made a record with them, produced by Mark Goldenberg from the Cretones. And I hung with Freddie and Demi every day for a year. The funny thing, I was driving with my girlfriend coming home from Hamilton 2 weeks ago. We were going on Santa Monica Boulevard. And I said, oh, that's where I used to work on Fairfax. And then the next block is this Mexican place, Los Tacos. We used to go there every day. And Freddie would put a quarter in the jukebox. And it would be, he's so shy, physical. And I forget the third track because he was a rocker who had a thing for the pop stuff. And then Demi went to make Blame It in Rio and a lot of things happened. Let me tell this story, though. We made the record. The record came out. And then Freddie did not tell me that he was invited Clive Davis to the gig. And I felt squeezed out, which I was. What do you have to know about musicians is they're desperate. They only have one chance. They will fuck over anybody to get where they want. And you have to understand, it's rational because if you're a manager, you can always get another act. If you're the musician, you have one shot. So I felt fucked over by the band and Freddie. He ultimately made it, goes, it's my one chance. But then Clive passed anyway. And then Charles called me up.
Karma.
Big believer in that. Not necessarily instant, although it was instant in this case. So then Charlie called me up and said, did you see this article in the newspaper about this band that throws meat into the audience? And I said, yeah, a band called Wasp. This is 1984. He says, I want to put that band in one of our movies. We'd made a previous movie, Metal Storm in 3D, which followed Jaws 3D into the movie theater. So I knew how to make a movie back when before video cams, et cetera. I literally knew how to do it.
Particularly in 3D.
Right, excuse me?
I said specifically in 3D.
Well, we knew how to do that too. But yeah. This movie we're making called Rage War, it starred the guy who ended up being Bull in Night Court. And I became very tight with the band Wasp. And they said, we sell out the Country Club. At the time, the Country Club was the big club out in Reseda, held about 1,000 people.
I think it's still there.
But they don't book gigs anymore, though.
Well, they definitely don't do 1,000 people.
Right. But in any event, I went on a Sunday night. There were like 900 people there. So I maintained my relationship with Blackie, who is Wasp. And he kept saying, oh, and I got this relationship with this guy, Rod Smallwood. It goes in one ear, went out another. And then he calls me one day. This is like 3 months later. He goes, can Rod Smallwood come in and meet you? To this day, Rod Smallwood is manager of Iron Maiden. And I said, sure, because I'm a fucking idiot. There's so many layers in the music business you learn. I thought Rod Smallwood wanted to meet me. He didn't want to meet me. I had 35 millimeter film of an unsigned band. That didn't exist in 1984.
Right.
So what he ultimately, after he listened to my horse shit for 30 minutes, he said he wanted to borrow one of the video cassettes. At the time, the standard was 3/4-inch video cassette. Right. I was number two at the company. There were two of these, only one in the building. It just couldn't disappear. So I basically said, finally I say, okay, you can take it. It just has to come back today. If it doesn't come back today, I'm going to lose my job.
Right.
Did come back. He went and made a 500 grand cash deal for Wasp because Iron Maiden was the biggest worldwide band on Capitol. And then the next day, Blackie calls me and goes, are you a lawyer? Yeah, I'm a lawyer. Went like 5 or 6 times because I really need to know. So, I have a bar card, okay? And I showed him the bar card when he came in. He goes, I need you to represent me in my deal with Sanctuary, which is the management company. So I negotiate that deal. Going back a step, when we mastered the Freddie Moore record, there was a fuck-up. In addition, my boss wrote a bad check. I ended up becoming very close with the mastering company. To this day, this guy, Stephen Markison, is one of the top mastering engineers in the world. So in any event,
20 or 30 years now, right?
Exactly. Yeah. So at the time, you would have to book mastering weeks in advance.
Right.
But Steven was a good friend of mine. And at the time, this guy at Sterling Sound was the guy who mastered all the metal. And they sent it to him, and it came back fucked up. And I asked Steven for a favor, and he cut it. But then you have to cut refs. And it takes, you can only cut, they had two lays, you get two at a time, they're doing cassettes, and the band is now antsy. So they go to the Rainbow, where you went every night, and I said I would bring the refs. I bring the refs, and Rod Smallwood is there, and he's all pushed out of shape. He can be an intense guy. What are you doing with the refs, blah, 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 and I explain the story, and he goes, you shouldn't be a lawyer, you should be a manager. When my partner comes back to town, I'm going to make a deal. These are still the guys who manage Iron Maiden. Just to be clear, it was Sanctuary Music, and then they ran out of money. They were kept alive by Ralph Simon at Zomba. Then they came back, and then they went public. Everybody invested. They took all their money out. They did well. Then it crashed. The assets were sold to Universal, but that was all after my time.
But by the way, Bob, right, I was there for a few years right before they went public. I was part of the crash.
It was like – That's a whole nother podcast.
Yes.
But, so they did, about 2 months later, Andy Taylor did come. We did make a deal. They bought this house that Chauncey Gardner, you know who I'm talking about.
Yeah, yeah, of course.
But who was the actor? Peter Sellers.
Right.
He had bought it and just gotten married, but he died before he could move in there.
Right, the Peter Sellers house.
Yeah, yeah, it was just above the Rainbow. They put me in.
I would say Inspector Clouseau, not
exactly.
Chauncey Gardner.
So they put, you know, they had a lot of cash. This is not the way the music business normally runs. Put 40 grand in one bank account, 80 grand in another bank account. And I remember them leaving. They're going to the airport. And they could only be in America 90 days at the time without paying taxes. They go, you have any cash? This is 1984. And I said, sure, how much do you need? I figured they're going to the airport. He goes, no, do you have any company cash? Well, you know, I got all this money in the bank, you know, blah, blah, blah. He goes, you're going to need cash. And they whipped out $4,500 cash. And I said, what am I going to do with $4,500 cash? And he goes, I put it in my front pocket. The irony being is you need that cash because when you're working with a rock band, it's got all these hangers-on believers who do work. None of them have a dollar. None of them have a credit card. And they would have to, like, I remember we had to rent a skeleton. You need a $1,000 deposit. So you'd whip off $1,000. So I ran the U.S. office, and I had to be the heavy. First and foremost, they could only be in America 90 days apiece. And there were things like we had a rich deal, and they had to fund the videos, and we were making a video. And the video, the first video was for 45 grand. The second was for 70 grand. And I had a lot of cash. I was about 17 grand in. And I called up to get a check from Capital for 20 grand. They say, we only write checks on Thursday. This was Monday. And I said, I need the check this week. Too bad. We only write checks on Thursday. And I called Rod, who was in the Bahamas. He goes, that's why I hired you. You have to do the work. So I had to call Capital. I said, either you write me the check or I'll bill you for the money I'm already in. Needless to say, I got the check.
Right.
But this comes up later. Then when you deal with any band, forget this pop thing where everybody's moldable. But back when they used to have real bands, you know, and that ended basically in the early 90s, they have like a 10-year plan, even though they're nobodies. They know what song's going to be a single, et cetera. So Blackie wanted to produce the album himself. Capitol wouldn't let them. So they had this guy, Mike Varney, who was famous for finding all the hot new rock guitars, produce it. The mix was terrible, okay? So I told Blackie it needed to be remixed. He said he would only remix it if Carter said otherwise. Carter was the A&R guy who's now deceased at Capitol. He's famous for two things. He wrote the lyrics to Incense and Peppermints, and he was the executive producer on Tina Turner's comeback. He deserves all the credit.
Wow.
So I bring the cassette into Carter. I play it for him. It's over, and he says, I passed on this band three times. Do whatever you want. And it's like, it was signed above me. So now I'm freaked out. But in the interim, Blackie played it for some other people. And he realized it needed to be remixed. I got this guy, Dwayne Barron, who had a huge hit with Quiet Riot. He rescued the record. But if you remember MTV, they would go through these phases of what they played. And they shifted to a non-metal phase. And Dwayne rescued another track we had a great video to. I said this should be the single because I cared about the music. To make a long story very short.
As you always have.
I got fired for standing up to the band. Rod Smallwood famously said, which if you put it in today's context, your head will spin like Reagan in The Exorcist. What difference does it make if the first album is unsuccessful? And
my head's spinning.
Right. And then I got fired. I had a ton of money because you can't spend a dollar when you have a job like that. And just to get to the key point we're actually at, then I couldn't get another job because everybody saw me as this big, heavy guy wielding power, okay?
And what year is this? What
year is this? 1984, 85.
Right.
I worked on a couple of movies because people I'd hired, they, you know, I was a music supervisor.
You had some music cred, yeah.
Right. And then I went to see a job counselor. And
wow.
my shrink said to do it. And she gave me this workbook from What Color Is Your Parachute, the famous job-seeking book.
Yeah, like one of the greatest books ever written.
Right. And
still to this day.
Right. The guy recently died, Bowles. And I wrote essays, and I got back in touch with the fact I love to write. Okay? And I sent something to magazines, and when the rejections came back, I said, wait a second. This is just like the music business. You have to know these people. Then I was eating a hamburger at Flaky Jake's. Doesn't exist anymore. It was the corner of Pico and Sepulveda.
I remember. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And I'm reading Billboard. It was one of its terrible phases. It got better with this guy, Timothy White. Then he died. It got worse again. And I'm reading. I go, this is terrible. I could do a better job than this. And I knew because I was constantly rewriting the bios that the publicity people had that I said, I could actually do this. So I went home and woke up my girlfriend. She says, you should do this. You should do this. And I knew there was a computer. I didn't have a computer at the time. And I thought about it for a week. And then I went out and charged up $5,000 worth of computer equipment on a credit card I'd gotten from being a lawyer. And I started this newsletter in the fall of 86. I sent 3,000 copies three times from a directory I got. I got the addresses from the Yellow Pages of Rock. This is from the Album Network, which also no longer exists.
I think it's important to add, this is the beginning
of the newsletter.
Of the Left Sets letter.
Exactly.
Right here and right now.
Exactly. This is it. And I was really doing it.
Just 86.
I was really doing it just to get another job in the music business. I didn't think it would be successful. The irony was, at the time, it came out every 2 weeks religiously. It was all analysis and business tips. I'm writing so much now, covering a lot of ground. But it was not like radio tips. It would be like, here's the situation. Here's how we analyze it. The head of every label subscribed. They all wanted to meet me. I thought people on the way up would subscribe. Fewer of those people because they were drinking the Kool-Aid. The top guy can have a different perspective. So I did that. For 4 years, always looking for other opportunities.
And to be clear, this was via fax.
No. It was via regular mail. I occasionally sent it via fax.
Like post stamp?
You got it.
Wow.
And it was a lot of effort.
I didn't get it until the early 90s.
Exactly, right. Yeah. So what happened was I ran out of money. My ex-wife moved out. It was really bad. I crashed really hard. I have a theory that everybody loses like 10 years of their lives, and that was my 10 years. And in the interim, the internet happened, and I had a free subscription to AOL. It's funny. I saw this guy just last night, Jeff Gold, who was the big, ended up being general manager of Warner Brothers. And he gave it to me in 1992 when people weren't really – I got a job writing for – the Pulse magazine, which was the arm of Tower Records. It was like Rolling Stone came out once a month.
Yeah.
And they paid me three times what anybody else paid, and they printed my address once. All these people were calling me and email and sending me letters, and then some woman in college said, can I email you? And I knew I had this AOL subscription, so I fired that up. Then there was a famous board on AOL called The Velvet Rope about the music business. And Julie Gordon.
Julie Gordon.
Okay. I started to participate on that. And then I started my own because they kept moving that, whatever. But I got very heavily into the internet. From 1995 to 2000, I was in every nook and cranny, became a big expert. Just to go two steps further, we were going to the Aspen conference. And in 1999, it was the first time the contact list had email addresses. Friends of mine worked in the book business for Random House. There's a famous book about David Geffen called The Operator.
Of course.
And I had it a weekend before anybody else. I wrote about it, sent it to all to my Aspen list. Response was great.
Then I got that.
I had a little directory. The Album Network all suddenly was having a directory with email addresses from some of their subscribers, and I could cross-reference some of my subscribers, and I sent it, and it was my first experience with virality, okay? As I remember hearing from all these people like Jefferson Holt, who used to be the manager of REM, okay?
Right.
And he said he got, and I said, you're not a subscriber. How'd you get it? I got it from Mark Williams, famous A&R guy. No,
and I think this is where I got in on it, too. I think it went viral. Somebody
exactly.
sent it
and
to me.
Mark Williams wasn't a subscriber either.
Right.
So then I stopped charging for subscriptions.
Right.
I stopped sending it by email. And if you were from an Aspen person, you were already a subscriber, you got it.
If you were in the circle.
If you were in the circle. You had to email me to get it. I did not automate it until 2005. The advantage to that was I was on the bleeding edge of all this stuff that people take for granted. Now, I'm not saying this is necessarily good stuff, but I'm talking about the hate and all this other stuff.
But what you also did is you built incredible credibility in the process.
Right.
Like you became authentic and credible as a voice.
Absolutely.
And no disrespect to Julie, but that Velvet Rope thing was not.
Right. I mean, well, that's just to go back there. The Velvet Rope was really a vicious thing.
Yes.
She left AOL, went somewhere else, and the guy who hosted this guy Craig Anderton, electronic musician,
right.
worked at Gibson until about a month ago, and a very nice guy. He said, I'll host one for you.
Right.
And we did it. What I didn't realize at the time was, this will sound kind of pompous, I would write definitively, people would be too intimidated to respond. So I did that for—
It became really important really fast.
Right. So I did that for like 2 years and was also burned out. But once, what happened was when I went online in the year 2000, that's when the whole Napster thing happened. And since I was a lawyer, I understood the legal stuff on Napster. I was the expert on Napster. They would call me everybody from Hillary Rosen, who was head of the RIAA. Everybody, I got right in the thick of
who
that.
Now you see on CNN.
Exactly, about political stuff.
Right. Yeah.
You know, she was, everybody hated her. In real life, she was basically an okay person.
Yeah, she's good.
But
goodish.
That's what happened. And there are many details because I thought that it was copyright infringement, but I thought that the labels would establish that and then have Napster go legal, which was not the case. So certainly by the fall of 2000, they went to shut it down. I became the expert on the other side, all of what was going on with the internet that they could not battle.
I guess there's one last question maybe here. Why the fuck are you doing this?
Well, that's an interesting question. Now, there's this guy, David Dorn, who's a big wig at Apple Music now. It was 2005. He tracked me down about doing this podcast for Rhino. And I did it all the way to
the
end of 2009. That podcast was about talking about records, and I could use any label, etc. And there was a very, it's like anything else, you know. I got email for years after it stopped. People would want to hear that again, okay? So I'm going to give you the real story.
The real story?
Yeah, yeah. So all right. In any event, David moved on. And that ended, okay? Podcast went down, and then they came back up. And everybody has a podcast, and Howard Stern is giving them shit. Everybody can broadcast, et cetera. And it's like, I don't want to write a novel. That's not what I do. My thing is immediate. People say, write a book. Say, I'm going to take a year or two to write a book that's going to reach a tenth of the people that I normally reach. That's not what I'm going to do. And the podcast, you know, it's like Peter Thiel says, you know, you go where everybody else isn't. But in the fall, 2 years ago, I lost my two big paying gigs. You know, nothing lasts forever. And one, the company, you know, literally went, both companies went in a different direction, but both stories are a little complicated, but I lost them both within a week. And I'd saved a lot of money, but it threw me. Okay.
And this is just like 2 years ago?
Or? Yeah. Okay. It was, you know, so this is, I had a column in Variety, and I had the these Spotify playlists I was doing for Rhino. And Rhino totally redid their thing. And Variety is a much deeper story, but it came to a close. And I hate to admit it. It's like, you know, a breakup for me. It takes a long time for me to recover from these
things. Yeah, it's hard to get over.
And also, I'll also admit, since I turned 60, really fucked me up. You know, everybody's saying, you know, no difference. They say 60 is the new 50 or new 40. That's horseshit. 60 is 60, okay? You might live a little bit longer. The problem with turning 60 is a lot of, it's a visceral thing. It's not something you contemplate till it comes up in your brain, is that a lot of it's bullshit. Like when I see hype, like I'm reading the newspaper now, and they talk about acts or they talk about movies, they said, they're just hyping it, okay? We don't know. I'll find out. I'll go on Rotten Tomatoes the day it comes out, find out whether it's worth seeing. I don't have to follow the promotion for a year in advance. So what is really important? And then you get to a spot where it goes, it doesn't make any difference. Because at first you want to be remembered. Then you realize nobody's going to be remembered. Young people today have no idea how big Johnny Carson was. And the Beatles continue to be big, but there are a lot of bands from the 70s who were huge, already been forgotten. So it frees you up to do different things, okay? Then I got an email from a guy. I do a certain number of personal appearances, certain number of podcasts myself, and I was on the Recode podcast, and I knew I killed, and I killed. And some guy tracked me down, this crazy Israeli guy, had the third biggest YouTube channel, if you discount Vivo. And he wanted to do a podcast, and I liked that he was young, okay? And I said, well, maybe I'll take a flyer. Then Irving Azoff said, well, a big radio chain was interested. So a big radio chain, we were at paper. I was going to do it with a big radio chain, okay? And then the guy who is head of TuneIn tracked me down. And he said, well, I said, you literally have to get on it right away. I mean, I'm literally, the contracts are going back and forth. So I liked once again that he was from the new world. And part of me believes I'm too late. I listen to a lot of podcasts, and many people are bad. It's astounding how many people are truly bad, and then there are people whose followings are bad. Because I was brought up in a family where they told me I was a shithead. My mother would literally say, "Well, who are you? Why'd they listen to you?" So I realized, well, if I'm good on these other things, I need to give it a shot. And also, I realized there are a lot of people I do want to talk to, which has a different flavor. From writing.
And you have access to.
Exactly. Like, I'm going to talk to Nathan Hubbard, who ran Ticketmaster and is in the ticketing sphere. That is not, no matter how much you write, it's not something that you can converse. And there are a lot of other people, I mean, I haven't locked these people in, not that they won't lock them, because I don't want to drop the names. There are a lot of creative people.
You're going to get them all, dude.
Okay.
All of them.
But as I say, I like to get someone's story. I don't want to just hear the hype. And I don't think there's anybody better. That's my skill, to my detriment. I know everybody's story. You heard about me. Most people, you never hear about me. It's like, it's just a newsletter. That's it. So I love to get people's stories. So I look forward to that in the podcast.
Well, I just want to share one story with you. 2002, as your letter is blowing up, you know, I'm still a relatively young man at that time. I was so inspired that I thought I would try to do the same thing. And I never really was able to pull it off.
I didn't know this. So did you send stuff?
No, I didn't send stuff. You know what I did is I would go out. I was on Sunset Strip every night, as you know.
Right.
I'd go out. I'd come home after many drinks and partying. And I would try to write something. And I could never do it in the way that you did it. So you were such an inspiration to me. And to this day, I wish that I had tried to follow through with this. But Bob, thank you for letting me help tell your story.
My goal is to make your life more interesting. That's what I'm trying to do here on my new podcast on TuneIn. I want to give you information and entertain you simultaneously in a world full of clutter. I hope to rise above. We love insight. You can email me at bob@leftsets.com and let us know what you think and suggestions. We're open to all ideas. I hope you enjoyed this inaugural podcast. Be sure to subscribe at TuneIn, iTunes, or your podcast player of choice. Think of any reason. Don't know exactly why. Must be it's out.